I'm going to try to cover in 10 minutes three topics. The first is the rigor of science, and this is all part of keeping science apart from government. The second is bringing them together, which is the process of becoming a chief scientific advisor, and that is your key function. And the third is communication. So let me just go to the rigor of scientific discovery, divorced from political influence. This is the principle of academic freedom, of course, in our universities. So I just want to say this is the key thing. The prime quality of the scientific research in our universities is that it's free from political interference. But the prime quality of a government chief scientific advisor, who is expected to be appointed on the basis of being a world-leading scientific expert at the cutting edge of some field of research, the prime objective there is to interact with the political system. So I spent 35 years of my career establishing the credentials in scientific capability, and then went into government. And there, the function is, and Angela's described it very well, is to be a bridge between current science and the political system. The first chief scientific advisor was Lindemann, and his second in command was Solly Zuckerman during the Second World War, appointed at the request of Winston Churchill. And for example, Solly Zuckerman gave advice on the conduct of the war. It wasn't just weapons, it wasn't just radar, it was also the conduct of the war. And a key piece of advice was on advising Churchill, who had already made a decision on this issue, where his decision was in advance of the landing of the Allied forces in France, that there should be carpet bombing of cities and factories in Germany. And instead, he advised that there should be strategic bombing of railways and bridges so that troops, German troops, couldn't be switched across to the landing place where the landing occurred. This was direct advice, and there was an argument with Churchill, and in the end, the advice was taken. So I'm going to say a science advisor in government must advise on policies based on the best science, but of course, and critically, the politicians decide. Absolutely. No disagreement with Angela whatsoever. The buck finally stops with the Prime Minister. Now, the story about the first government chief scientific advisor emerges well after the appointments that I've just described. This is when Solly Zuckerman was the Ministry of Defense chief scientific advisor, and Dennis Healy was the minister, and Healy went to Wilson and complained that this man was trying to interfere with all of his decisions. And so Wilson met with Solly Zuckerman, and he agreed to take Solly into his office as chief scientific advisor. So that was the first government chief scientific advisor. I'm just saying this because relationships can become a little bit tight sometimes. So let me just move on to the policy issues in science and technology. So first of all, I'm going to read out to you what the statement is in the current document that you go to in government to see what the function is. The government chief scientific advisor, and I'm reading, advises the prime minister and the cabinet on science and technology policy issues which cut across individual government departments. That's a very clear statement in which you will see advising on policy issues is the key function. So when it comes to policy issues, I moved into government shortly after the BSE crisis in the British farming community. British cattle had BSE, and it was a terrible disaster for our farming community. And after the crisis was over, this was a report was made by the Phillips Commission, Lord Phillips leading this, Commission, and that report was published just in the month that I was appointed as Chief Scientific Advisor with Tony Blair. And I read at least the first volume of this 12-volume report, and that really became my mantra throughout my period in government, which what it said was very clearly that the government chief scientific advisor and other chief scientific advisors must be able to put their advice into the government ministers, into cabinet, but also into the public domain. And the reason for the Phillips Commission report saying this was quite simple, that during this epidemic amongst the cattle, the government minister concerned, the minister of what was then a Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Fisheries, was trying to persuade the public that British beef was perfectly safe to eat, and even fed his daughter a hamburger on television. And this was at a time when it was understood that variant CJD, a new human brain disease, was probably arising from people eating British beef. And so the science advisors were kept away from the television. And what Phillips said quite simply is, when they said they were following science advice, the people couldn't understand whether or not that was true. And so he said the science advisors must be able to go into the public domain with their advice. And that was the mode in which I operated, foot and mouth disease epidemic, when the Prime Minister at a COBRA meeting asked everyone at the meeting whether they had advice. And when it came to my turn, I was the only one who could deliver advice that I'd obtained from a group of epidemiologists and veterinary scientists drawn from outside government. And so it wasn't long before the Prime Minister asked me to effectively take over the management of that epidemic, and I set up a committee. And on the committee, of course, I had not only science advisors, but I also brought in veterinary scientists from outside government. I had the chief veterinary officer on board. And perhaps critically, I had a Ministry of Defence strategic expert who does all of the calculations for the capability of the Ministry of Defence in any war operation. And the Ministry of Defence was absolutely key to the management of the foot and mouth disease epidemic. So it was the Prime Minister, and I was meeting him once a day, who was taking decisions, but the decisions were always to back me and back the decisions of the committee all the way through that that pandemic, quite simply because, as the Prime Minister wrote in his autobiography, he didn't really understand the science underlying what we were doing. And so handed over to the scientists who could manage it. Subsequently, I set up the government's foresight program in an in-depth way. We had a foresight program. It was rather superficial. And I turned it into an in-depth instrument. Each program involved at least 100 experts, the biggest program, 350 experts, and worked for 2 to 3 years to deliver an in-depth foresight analysis with scenarios built forward in time. The longest scenario went out to 2080, where we were looking at flood and coastal defense problems for the UK out to 2080, with all of the best calculations we had available on climate change and how flood risk would increase with rising sea levels over that period of time. That report, when it went into government, I put it to the cabinet. Blair asked me to talk in parliament about it. The meeting was attended by members of both houses of parliament. And the upshot of all of that was the British government's decision to lead the way in the global negotiations. We arrived at this 80% reduction by 2050 as our unilateral indicator of how seriously we were taking this. So I would say it was successful. But let me just quickly say, alongside that, I ran a big program on cognitive systems, and this was really looking at our capability in IT and in brain science and putting these two together 2001 to 2003 was this program, which really in a way foresees AI. And what has emerged from that is a number of new university departments following on that work. Now, the key point I do want to make about these programs is that I brought in at least one Minister of Government to chair each program, because the final object of the game was to see that the four scenarios that we always predicted forward in time, one of them was very attractive and one of them was not at all attractive. So ministers had to be brought in to see that we started moving in the more attractive direction and took the right decisions to reach that. Infectious diseases was the biggest project that I ran at that time in the Foresight program. And it was that program published in Go Science in 2006 that foresaw a pandemic of the kind that is now causing such a lot of damage to the global system and to the global economics. Now, the third point and my last point is I just want to say the GCSA must be a good and clear communicator. Jargon-free, but with rigor, is the critical aspect of that. And so following through from what I'm saying to you now, I set up Independent Sage because I was frankly worried that we were not told who was on the government Sage. We were not told any of their processes of decision-making, and nor did we see a free chief scientific advisor, chief medical officer, available for requests to go on the media and to be challenged by the media. So when I set Sage up, Independent Sage up, we didn't know even who the people on Sage were. Now, I think what you will know is that we have continued to the present time. There has been some criticism of this, but the most important thing I do want to stress is that we are a group of experts who include a good group of healthcare specialists. We also have experts on operational health. This means that we're looking right across the board and are able to give policy advice on the basis of that. I stress again, the decision rests with the Prime Minister at all times. So it's an orchestra of specialists. I am simply the conductor of the orchestra. But I do also want to say that all members of the group are taking up frequent invitations to appear on television and radio and the press. And I must admit, none of us expected this. But of course, there is a very big appetite out there for experts to talk up where we are, what the policies are, and what needs to be done. So I just leave you with that. No one else is fulfilling this role in terms of the public. And if we're going to have an advisory system that manages the trust of both the government, the cabinet, the prime minister, and on the other hand, the public, that is what we need.